Okay, can everybody hear us? Are we all ready? I think perhaps the sooner we start, the sooner we'll finish. And what we'd like to do is to allow you to get away to your commitments quickly. And we're hoping to finish at about 10 to 9. And hopefully we'll be able to stick to that format. Thank you, everybody, for coming along this morning to what we hope will be an informative session. I suppose what I'd like to do at the outset is thank Michael Green and his staff, in particular Brett Bowker, Luke Hales and Matthew Green, for their promotion of this presentation. Green's List staff actually prevail upon us to come and give talks like this, and we're not always as enthusiastic as perhaps we should be, but it's a credit to Green's List because they really do try to promote the barristers on the list, but also to provide the solicitors with what we'd like to think is an informative and informal session, and we'd hope you come away learning something and that it's been of benefit, and it's an easy way to gain a CPD point, we'd like to think. And so it is that in relation to the coroner's court, whether you're practicing in common law, criminal law, occupational health and safety or whatever, it's a jurisdiction that you need to have an understanding about, we'd like to think. And we're finding that a lot of the work that we do on Green's List is at the coroner's court, and so we're fortunate today to have two excellent speakers who are able to share their knowledge gained from having appeared there on a regular basis. And the first speaker to my right, I'll introduce, will be familiar to you as Anya McGee, a very experienced litigator, a former partner of Phillips Fox, as it then was. And since coming to the bar, I suppose, Anya has represented so many different people and organisations at inquests, including, I've made a note of families, doctors, hospitals, psychiatric units, nursing homes, kindergartens, landlords, schools, local councils, Transport Accident Commission, various government departments, to name just a few. That's fair to say, isn't it, Anya? And what we're going to do is, or Anya and Megan have elected to choose to speak on not any one topic for the entirety of the session, but to just touch on a number of topics. We'll sit from 7:30 to 8:20 talking about, with Anya, reportable deaths, such exciting things as release of the body, interested parties, the scope of the inquest, control over tissue samples. And then Megan's going to address the Open Court Act and suppression orders. And Anya and Megan are both going to talk about practice directions. Then we'll have a break for 15 minutes, have a cup of tea and a biggie, and then we'll come back representing families, Megan will talk about, and Section 57 applications, privilege in relating to self-incrimination, and the revival of the users forum. Before we'll open up the floor to some questions, and then, as I've discussed with Andrew Smith, he'll take all your questions. So I'm only joking, we'll answer the questions. And so what we might do is start and with Anya, who's going to talk about reportable deaths. And I suppose, Anya, what I might do by way of, just so we can kickstart the conversation, is to point out or ask you about how it is that although the coroner has an obligation to investigate reportable deaths, it's not always the case that the coroner will actually conduct a formal open hearing, isn't it? And that the family may need to prompt the coroner to conduct a formal hearing.
That's correct. And it's a good introduction and a good question, Sean, thanks. Because it's not always the coroner that kicks the investigation off. Sometimes, as Sean has said, the family needs to become proactive and push a bit, and we've seen examples of that in the media in recent times. There's also a broad range of other organisations that may report deaths to coroners, and the definition now in the Act is much broader than it was in the previous Act. I've put in the paper, and I'm not going to go through it slavishly, but a reportable death is defined as a death in Victoria, a body in Victoria, a cause of death which occurs in Victoria, or the death of a person ordinarily resident in Victoria. So that's pretty broad. It's where the death appears to have been unexpected, it appears to have been unnatural, it appears to have been violent. So they're all different separate elements, or appears to have resulted directly or indirectly from an accident or injury, or where death occurs during a medical procedure or following a medical procedure where the death may be causally related to the medical procedure, and in those situations where a registered medical practitioner would not, immediately before the procedure had been undertaken, have reasonably expected the death. Now, that is an extension of the earlier definition under the previous Act, which looked at deaths occurring during anaesthesia or associated or consequential upon anaesthesia. So you can see immediately that that is the new definition is a much broader definition when it looks at the medical type of issues and questions. A reportable death also is where a person's in custody or care, a patient under the Mental Health Act, a person under the control or custody of the Secretary of the Department of Justice or the police, a person under a non-custodial sentence or a supervision order, I beg your pardon, supervision order under the Crimes, Mental Impairment and Unfitness to be Tried Act, a person of unknown identity, a person where a doctor has not provided a death notice under the Births, Marriages and Deaths Act and is not likely to do so, a death outside Victoria where the cause of death isn't certified. If I could just stop there, that would be someone who is ordinarily resident in Victoria but dies outside Victoria. And an example of that was the inquest into the death of David Wilson in Cambodia. And another example in the New South Wales context is the inquiry into the death of Greg Shackleton and the Balabo Five in East Timor. The reason that the coroner had jurisdiction in those cases was because the person was ordinarily resident in Victoria. And the other class of death is a death of a prescribed class of a person which occurs in prescribed circumstances. Now, there are occasions where, as a result of an inquest, the coroner's net perhaps is expanded. And an example of that, and I haven't put it in the paper, but I'll give you the reference to it, is an inquest into the death of Fikri, F-I-K-R-I, Memedovsky. It's a 2009 coroner's court case, but the findings were delivered in October 2012. And that case highlighted the need for improved education and awareness of the medical profession about their obligations to report to the coroner. And it led to a pilot program to assist medical practitioners to understand what their obligations were under the Coroner's Act, and a further pilot program which commenced in November 2012. As part of the recommendations in Memedovsky, the Medical Board of Victoria was asked to communicate to its members, reminding them of their responsibility about reportable deaths, and also that the Register of Births, Marriages and Deaths and Marriages considered amending their guidelines on medical certificates to draw attention to two specific areas that were highlighted as a result of that case. And one was head injuries and one was fractures. And as part of that case, there was a review of reportable deaths. And that led to the net being perhaps cast wider than would normally be expected. And I became involved in a case called Hassan, where the Registrar of Births, Marriages and Deaths reported a death directly to the coroner of an 87-year-old man who died in July 2010. The inquest wasn't heard until a few years later and after the Memedovsky inquest. And I became involved because the medical certificate referred to the possible trauma associated with death, including the subdural hematoma and a fractured hip. And one of the areas that was captured by this inquiry that the coroner undertook was elderly patients who die shortly after suffering a fall and a fractured neck or femur. So it became an area of interest to the coroner. In Hassan, I was representing the general practitioner, and he was required to attend the coroner's court and give evidence because of the death certificate and because he hadn't made a formal notice of a reportable death. What was not in issue was his clinical care. There was no suggestion that his clinical care in any way contributed to the death. But what the coroner was concerned about was the general practitioner should have identified it as a reportable death. So he got caught in that new inquiry. And the case highlighted, again, issues about the obligations and responsibilities of medical practitioners to report appropriate deaths. Now, in that case, the doctor had recognised that he had had an obligation which he hadn't fulfilled. He'd gone and obtained further equivalent CPD and education. He had undertaken all of those things before the coronial inquiry, and he gave evidence as to the steps he'd taken to improve his own knowledge, and also in the intervening time between 2010 and the time of the inquest, the medical board had set out some information to its members and published an article in the medical board update in 2013 reminding members of their obligations. So whilst no adverse findings were made against the doctor in that case, and there was no adverse comment about him at all, it did highlight how doctors can, in certain circumstances, be caught and required to explain their behaviour, even though that behaviour was not implicated in the death at all. So the reason I raise that for your edification is because sometimes a doctor might get a call from a medical client who says, why am I being asked anything about this inquest? I haven't been treating the patient or I didn't treat the patient beforehand or whatever. That might be the context in which they get they're required to give some evidence.
Well, we skip to this one because we're going to be pressed for time, I think.
Oh, look, I'll just go a little bit faster. The release of body. There are instances where family disturbances and matrimonial issues will mean that there is a dispute between family members about who gets the body back from the coroner. And this is coalface stuff. This is early in the piece, obviously shortly after the death. Emotions are high, and there can be some difficulties that one has to contend with if you have a client who wants the release of their loved one and there's a competing interest. In the papers, I've identified a recent case of Carter and the Coroner's Court in Holyfield, and I'll leave it to you if this is a case that interests you to have a look at, but essentially Ms. Carter was living with a gentleman called Mr. Holyfield. He reported her death. The body was going to be released to him. Ms. Carter's sister asked for the body to be released to her. They were of Aboriginal extract, and there were issues about whether it was appropriate to have the lady buried at Lake Tyres or cremated. It ended up in the Supreme Court, and ultimately the body was released to Mr. Holyfield, the partner. There was issues and evidence about the deceased's own personal preferences. One of the other issues there was the fact that not all the material had been supplied to the sister by the coroner's court, and the court found that was a breach of natural justice. So there's two components that you might want to look at that case about.
Bonnie, can I just ask, you're about to go on to apply to be an interested party in an inquest. Would you agree, it's certainly my experience, and solicitors would be interested to perhaps be aware of how it is that, in my experience and perhaps yours, the coroner's court will be fairly liberal in granting interested party status.
They may or they may not.
There was this case recently. We've all heard about it in the media of the VW driver driving along and the car just stopped and there was an accident and somebody died, and then the manufacturer, the VW manufacturer, was granted interested party status. And so if solicitors here have got people coming to them to say, look, would we be able to be represented at the hearing? It's that sort of scenario which suggests, well, maybe a liberal attitude will be taken by the court, and so parties may then be represented.
I caution people not to assume that they'll get leave. Mm. In the majority of cases, you will get leave if you've got a sufficient interest. If you're a family member, a spouse, or someone like that. If you're an employer in an industrial accident, if you're the teacher of a child on a school excursion, if you're the owner of a property where someone had died and things like that, where you can see there's a close temporal link. Mm. But there are occasions where the coroner will say, I won't allow that. And I can give you some examples. One was where I was acting for, I think it was the Department of Primary Industries and DSE, where a child had been killed by a dog in a home. There was a suggestion that the dog was a dingo breed, and the department had various guidelines about how those animals should be housed, and very strict guidelines about the sort of enclosures that they need to be in. The coroner decided that the breed of dog wasn't of interest to him. He was more interested in the actual circumstances of the attack on the child and the fact that the child bled to death.
They want to keep a cap on
proceedings. So they want to keep it limited. In that case also, the Dingo Association was denied leave because the coroner said, I'm not interested in breed of dog, I'm interested in what actually happened to the child and what happened when the medical teams arrived and what happened at hospital. So he wasn't prepared to go backwards and was going forward. So that was an example where my client was concerned that there may have been some adverse comments made about it. But when leave was not granted, it perhaps gave it a level of comfort, because obviously if leave's not granted, the coroner will not, it's highly unlikely that the coroner would make any adverse comments about your client, because if it was in their minds to make any adverse comments, then you would have leave. So it goes around in circles in a way.
So leave will be granted if the court's satisfied of a couple of things in particular.
Yes.
Right. You were distracted you from your.
No, that's all right. And look, and also as a matter of practicality, there were other examples where an organisation where there was an allegation made that a child had been exposed to some peanut butter. The coroner declined an application by Anaphylaxis Australia. For leave to appear, they remained in at the inquest, and but they weren't allowed to be officially represented. And there are situations sometimes where leave is actually granted, and then shortly prior to the inquest, you'll get a communication from the court that you're not required to appear. I don't know whether anyone else has had that experience, but it certainly happened on at least one occasion to me, where the coroner had some inquiries about a particular system of leave from school. Some children were away from school for some various periods of time. They died in very tragic circumstances well away from the school. And the coroner was interested in whether there were any trigger points about the number of days the children were not at school to have some alarms going off. The Department of Education addressed those issues, provided witness statements, provided all the information that was available, the school records, how in fact when you analyse the records the children weren't away for any inordinate length of time. And in those circumstances it was either the day before or 2 days before the inquest, my instructing solicitors were contacted by the coroner's court and said, we do not require you to appear. And so that meant that the, as far as my client was concerned, the queries were adequately answered. And there was no comment, apart from the comment in the ultimate findings, the comment was that the queries had been responded to appropriately. So whilst initially leave was granted to appear, it was effectively withdrawn before the hearing.
It's sometimes the case too that interested parties will be given sort of leave of a limited scope. Mm. You see that quite a bit with specialist community legal services that want to get involved in a particular inquest because there's a sort of greater preventative purpose and public purpose in advocating a particular issue, but the coroner will give them limited leave in terms of making submissions but not cross-examining witnesses or those sorts of things to try and confine the duration of the inquest.
And there are other occasions where something arises in the running of an inquest that the next day or in that afternoon somebody has to charge down to the coroner's court and seek leave to appear. And they might have leave, and it might be a discrete issue, and they're there for a day or two, and then they can leave. So people have to be mindful that issues can arise in the running. You were going
I
to
didn't
say something?
Introduce Megan. Now that Megan's contributing at this stage, I'll introduce Megan as our second speaker. Megan's inquest work, I suppose, fits neatly into her practice of personal injuries and professional negligence and regulatory prosecutions, coming from Landers as she has. She has a keen interest in investigatory work, and I suppose it's fair to say, an eye for detail. She acts for families and interested parties in inquests, and particularly enjoys the inquisitorial nature of inquests, and that's not surprising because it's apparent, at least from my perspective, having been involved in inquests with Megan, that Megan will utilise the inquest proceedings as a means to access or assess the evidence upon which subsequent damages proceedings might be based. And so we're grateful for Megan's input. I interrupted you,
sorry. All right. That's all right. Well, it's part of having a panel, isn't it? I've made some notes for you about applying to be an interested party, about the procedure, the classes of people that may or may not be found to be interested parties. Just remember there's two limbs. One is that you have to have a sufficient interest, and the second is the coroner has to be satisfied that it's appropriate for you to be, or your client to be, an interested party. The process of two forms relevant are Form 31 and Form 45. I've highlighted those in the paper. If you get leave, then you will get the documentation, and so you probably don't need the Form 45, but I recommend that people might put them in at the same time, because if you don't get leave, you will then get the documents. So they're just some procedural issues. Obviously, if you get leave, you've got the right to be... the client's got the right to be legally represented and make submissions regarding the calling of witnesses, and make submissions finally at the conclusion of the evidence. Then go on to the scope of inquest, and this is something that Megan will address also, but it's important to ascertain as soon as you can, or at an earliest possible date, what the scope of the inquest is, so that you can then properly prepare and advise your clients. They're often discussed at directions hearings, so it's important that interested parties are at directions hearings to find out what area, what matters are of interest to the coroner. And ascertaining those areas early may assist the interested party in identifying appropriate witnesses and in some cases, or in many cases, additional witnesses that might assist the coroner. I've highlighted how the coroner has the power to make recommendations regarding public health and safety issues and the administration of justice, and that seems to be a major push by the coroner now, is that broader base of their powers. But in the past, they have looked at things like Mistral fans and motor vehicles of a particular type to see whether there are inherent safety issues that are arising. Be mindful that a coroner's inquest is not a royal commission. It's not wide-ranging. It has to have its limitations. It has to have some parameters. And it's important that those parameters are identified as early as possible. And sometimes the parameters will shift as the evidence shifts. And that's going back to the example I gave earlier about how sometimes in the course of an inquest, a party who had not had an interest earlier might then have an interest and need to be represented. Now, one of the issues, and it comes into the discussion we'll have in a few minutes about the practice directions, but up until the new practice directions of 2014, it certainly has been my practice when I am briefed to pick up the phone and introduce myself to the police assisting the coroner. And subject to that practice direction, I used to always ask, well, what are the areas of concern to the coroner, and what areas can my client assist you with, so that I can get an understanding of what the issues are?
It's really important, I've found, that for the solicitor to provide us with, if they can, a copy of the transcript of the directions hearing, because then you really gain an appreciation of what the issues of concern are. Mm. You will prepare a matter thinking that the coroner might be interested in a particular area, and find that that hasn't been articulated as one of the areas of interest to the coroner, and so you're wasting your time, aren't you, and spending time. And also you have the conference with your client talking about things that aren't necessarily going to involve us in the issues of concern. So it's best if you can get the transcript at counsel of the directions hearing early in the piece, or if not the transcript, just a notation of what the particular issues have been identified as. Very helpful.
Or ideally, if you're going to use counsel, get them in early and get them to go along through the directions hearing.
Either way, it's very important to use counsel, I think.
Oh, we'd always say that. We have to say that. It's part of our mantra. So,
Greens List.
Yes. but it is something that you can, if you don't know the scope, you're wide-ranging yourself. And if you do know the scope, then you can hone in on the areas of concern to the coroner. And going back to the example that I used earlier about the school, when the areas of concern were addressed, it meant that my client didn't need to appear at the actual inquiry. Be mindful that the coroner is not bound by the rules of evidence, has a duty to afford procedural fairness and the principles of natural justice. How are we going for time?
Going all right.
I'm sorry if I'm rushing over these things, but there's a lot of information here, and we can come back to discuss specific issues later if it's of assistance. An area that I thought might be of interest to people is the next topic, which is control over tissue samples. It's something that doesn't happen very often, but it is a sort of a quirky sort of area. And the discussion arose recently in a case of Dane and Dr. Jane Hentler sitting as coroner, 2012 VSC 454, where the coroner wanted to impose conditions on an interested party before she would release the material to the interested party. The circumstances were that there was an investigation into the death of a gentleman called Rodney Moore, and the pathologist had concluded that the cause of death was, in effect, blood in the space in the lining between the abdominal wall and the internal organs after a gallbladder operation. The applicant in the Supreme Court, or the plaintiff in the Supreme Court, Peter Dan, had performed the operation, and he disputed the pathologist's conclusions about the cause of death. He asked for access to the post-mortem CT scan, a series of photographs, and some tissue samples which had been used for histopathological analysis. On the first day of the inquest, the coroner ruled that those materials would be provided, but only if Mr. Dan agreed to provide the coroner with any report prepared for him in response and looking at that material. So in other words, the coroner said, well, you can have the material, but whatever report you may get, I want. And Mr. Dan refused to accept that condition, and he sought judicial review of it on the basis that the imposition of the condition was beyond the coroner's power, and it constituted an error of law. And Justice Kyrou found that both grounds were made out. The court accepted that the coroner should give directions about tissue samples, particularly their storage and use, and could give those directions until they were no longer required for any function under the Act. The court found that the surgeon was entitled to be given a fair opportunity to inspect the items under the condition that he would preserve the integrity of the items. And given the nature of the items involved, fairness required that he be able to involve his lawyers and medical experts in the inspection process. And I draw your attention to paragraph 24 of the case, which basically said the fettering of that right of the access was inappropriate. It significantly undermined the doctor's ability to use the items to protect his interests at the inquest, and constituted an effective denial of natural justice. The court said he had the right to obtain access to the items in a manner that facilitated the frank and confidential, advice from his lawyers and his experts to enable him to make informed forensic decisions about the best way to protect his interests at the inquest. Can I just stop there? This is dealing with the doctor being able to protect his own interests. It's not the coroner making her own general inquiries. And the court said that those conditions impugned him of his rights, and there were issues about the denial of legal privilege, and I noticed that there's a typo in the paper, and I'm sorry. Somehow a little figure 9 just got itself in there. But said that that condition undermined any privilege, such as legal professional privilege or client legal privilege. And said the coroner's court didn't have power to undermine such privileges. So when you're looking at trying to get material from the coroner's court in unusual circumstances where you want to get access to that sort of material, have a look at that decision, read it carefully, and think about how you, what steps you can take to protect your client's own interests.
Well, we're moving now to the topic of the Open Courts Act and suppression orders. And I might start by asking Megan something, because I'm sure it's the case so regularly that solicitors here will be confronted with clients who are very concerned as they enter an inquest in circumstances where they're concerned about their reputation. They think they're going to be attacked, or it's obvious that they're going to be attacked. Their management of a patient, for example, is under question, and so they're very worried. They think that they're going to be in the media and so forth. So in the current climate, now that we've got the Open Court Act, how is it, what's the likelihood, for example, that their name might be ordered to be anonymised?
Well, I guess there's a few things that you'd need to think about in a situation like that. The Open Courts Act has applied since the end of last year, and it applies in the coroner's court, but the particular criteria for the granting of a suppression order is specific to the coroner's court, and it's different from every other jurisdiction in Victoria. And it's unfortunate that frequently when the coroner's court makes rulings on suppression order applications, they don't publish detailed reasons, that the non-publication order is simply published on the website, and it's difficult to access any sort of background on what the criteria are that are being considered by the court. However, the criteria hasn't changed. That is that an order can be made suppressing an identity or suppressing information if it would be likely to prejudice a fair trial of a person or if it's contrary to the public interest. But the weighing up factors are shifted somewhat by the Open Courts Act, which places an emphasis on the publication of information and, of course, as the name suggests, courts being open to the public. A major consideration you'd want to make before advising a client, particularly a professional client who's concerned about reputational issues, before making an application for a suppression order, is that now under the Open Courts Act there's a notification requirement. So you have to give notice to the court that you're going to make a suppression order application, and then the court gives notice to all media outlets.
So you're potentially inviting the media to come along in circumstances where they wouldn't have in the past.
Yeah.
So you're highlighting the fact that there's an issue.
Yeah. And I mean, as it is, coroner's proceedings do attract a significantly higher level of media interest than a lot of other court proceedings. And quite often they involve material that, you know, the media sees as quite salacious or appealing. And it may be that you're better off, particularly if your chances of getting a suppression order are relatively slim, you might be better off to not make that application because you don't want to be publicising the fact of the application, which might just draw attention to the fact that there's something interesting going on. The Coroner's Court Act, of course, places an emphasis on the preventative role of the court and the promotion of public health and safety. So it there's no presumption in favour of a person being able to suppress information. The Open Courts Act increases that emphasis, so it certainly makes it clear that there is a preference for maintaining a system of open justice and ensuring that people can attend proceedings and that the media can appropriately report on proceedings. The Coroner's Court actually publishes a very interesting media guideline which deals with all sorts of rules on what the media can and can't do in terms of attending proceedings, in terms of making electronic communications while in court and obtaining footage, recordings and other material from inquest briefs. So if your clients are concerned about media interest, then I'd highly recommend that you have a look at that guideline. In terms of the major changes that have come about because of the Open Courts Act, it used to be the case that if the criteria for making a suppression order were satisfied in the coroner's court, that is that the disclosure would be likely to prejudice the fair trial of a person or be contrary to the public interest, the coroner must make an order. Now the coroner may make an order in those circumstances. From the material available, it doesn't appear that the coroner's court is making less suppression orders. The major change perhaps would be that under the Open Courts Act, there is a requirement that that orders be made in a very defined way and for the minimum time necessary to ensure that the purposes of the order are obtained. So what we're seeing now in terms of suppression orders in the coroner's court is that they are time limited. Typically 5 years seems to be the length of time that people are getting these orders for, and that's probably because the Act talks about requiring that suppression orders have a fixed period, and unless they are referable to a particular future event that will happen, then the fixed period shouldn't exceed 5 years. The suppression order also must be made on the basis of evidence or of credible information to support the grounds for making the order. And so we might find that there is an increase in opposition to the making of orders that perhaps weren't opposed in the past. It doesn't seem likely that that there will be less orders. The criteria aren't substantially changed for making orders in the coroner's court. An interesting issue to consider with respect to the notice provisions is that there may be scope for complying with the notice provisions, but ensuring that the name of your client isn't released to the public in the process of complying with those provisions, and that would be potentially available by applying to the court without notice for an interim suppression order and then making notice with the suppression order in place or an anonymisation order in place, so the notice might be able to be given in an anonymised form. And that was the approach that Justice Elliott took in the Supreme Court proceedings of the PFM and the Legal Services Commissioner, which are referred to in the paper. In that particular case, His Honour took the view that the notice provisions were in the Act for a reason and that it was important that they were complied with, even though there was a submission made that the particular client who was seeking the order would be at increased risk of self-harm if notice was given to media organisations and the application drew media attention, and ordered that the notice be made in an anonymised form. So that might be a potential means for getting around some of the risks of giving notice, but it won't detract from the potential that giving notice will still draw attention to the inquest that may not have been otherwise drawn.
Megan, can I just give an example of a suppression order that I experienced before the Open Courts Act. It was down in a provincial town, small town, where parents of a young child had been taking prescription medication, and their two-year-old got hold of an oxycodone tablet, and you can imagine the outcome. It wasn't a good outcome. The parents had two or three other children in this small country town, and the parents were separately represented. I was representing a maternal health care nurse, just because there were inquiries about what the overall standard of care was from the parents. An application was made by both parents for a suppression order because they said that the remaining children who were at school had been subject to ridicule and actually had to be moved out of the school to another school because of the publicity that had surrounded this particular case. And the coroner in that instance thought that the rights of the remaining children overrode any rights of the media and granted the suppression order. Do you think that situation would be considered any different with the new regime?
I think that it's unlikely that the making of an order in a situation like that would be affected by the Open Courts Act. Mm-hmm. The criteria is still the same, and it would certainly be still strongly arguable that it's contrary to the public interest to publish the names of children who have, you know, been involved in a proceeding like that with no fault on their parts and no and potential grave consequences.
Can I say the media was actually there and they walked out without a murmur. They made no submissions against the suppression order, although the coroner did give them the opportunity.
Yeah.
That might have something to do with the nature of the area that it was, because they were the small provincial newspapers rather than perhaps more aggressive, larger newspapers. I don't know.
It may be the case that that the scope of the order would be affected. Mm-hmm. For example, I'm not sure what the scope was in that particular case, but if it was a complete suppression order forever, it might be that instead of saying nothing about this can be published, the coroner might make an order that says the identities and any other identifying features of these children can't be published, and that the order would probably have to be time limited, but it would be likely to be sort of have a sunset clause of 5 years if there's no further application made.
So we can all see the practical side of these sorts of things.
I should say though that in a situation like that as well, the coroner can hear, and any court can hear, an application for a suppression order without notice if the court concludes that it's in the interests of justice to do that, and certainly in a case where there's potential harm to children, it would be strongly arguable that you shouldn't have to comply with notice provisions, and that it's the interests of the children should be put before the interests of the media in having standing and the opportunity to make submissions.
We got a question.
Just on that point, I'm on a Julie Green one on Green's list as well, but I've done a number of inquests representing police, and I found there are some areas, certainly in relation to police, like defensive tactics, how police take down an offender, or in relation to high-speed police car chases, the speed at which a police officer might stop chasing another car. They're the kinds of things that are in the public interest to prevent that information getting out, so it's quite important to make an application for a suppression order. And I would have thought those were the kinds of things you would want to think about in relation to your clients and whether you should make an application without notice, because it's not the kind of thing you'd really want notice to get out to all the media, and there to be a delay on those questions when they're really important for public safety.
Yeah, well, it's a good point. In case anyone didn't hear, the point is that in cases involving often police contact deaths or other sort of similar cases, there's frequently application made by the police and presumably other similar sort of organisations to suppress information relating to police tactics, police policies, and the argument put is that the release of that information would be contrary to the public interest. For example, in an inquest I was involved in, there was a suppression order over evidence relating to the effective range of OC spray or capsicum spray. Similarly, it might be that rules about how fast police can go and at what point they have to call off a police chase might it might be contrary to the public interest that people know what those rules are and can essentially use them to the detriment of law enforcement. The question relates to whether an application for a suppression order in a case like that could be made without notice. In my view, it probably shouldn't be. The notice provision should be complied with. It's not a situation where anyone's at any imminent risk. What should probably be done is that an interim order should be sought before making the notice. The content of the material to be suppressed doesn't need to go in the notice. And this is a situation where the media should have the right to be heard. It's information that is of high interest to the public, but it's a question of whether the interests in suppressing that information outweigh the media interest in publishing it.
Megan, we better move on to that exciting topic of practice directions because we've got a couple of minutes before we have a cup of tea.
Right. Just to draw everyone's attention to the fact that there are seven new practice directions effective this year. The first six are from the 9th of April 2014 and the seventh is from the 24th of June 2014. Two deal with access to documents to next of kin and other parties. Practice direction number three is the one that I would draw people's attention to. That's about communications with the court. These are once you have your Form 31 in and you've got leave, and there's a new procedure, or there is a procedure, where the coroner's assistant can only be contacted in various situations. The court recommends now that communication by phone with the registrar, coroner's solicitor and or coroner's assistant should be avoided in all but administrative or routine matters. But even in relation to those matters, the communications should be in writing by email or by letter is preferable to avoid any misunderstanding or misapprehension in relation to the communication. It recommends that the emails be, everyone's copied into the emails, which you would normally do anyway if you're having any communication with the court. The issues about whether when there has been an inquest directed, that there will be no out-of-court communications regarding a hearing unless all other interested parties are included in any email correspondence. Just have a look at that practice direction and see how it marries in with your own practice of dealing with the coroner's assistant. Make sure that you're not offending the practice direction. And practically, I think one of the things one needs to do is when contacting the coroner's assistant now is ask them, well, who else is represented and do you have their emails? Can you give me their details? And then when you respond to the coroner's assistant, you copy everybody in so that everyone's on the same page. But whether the discussions that used to be had about scope of inquest and areas of concern for the coroner are now, whether they're now appropriate remains to be seen, but it's something that I flag for people's attention. And perhaps the way to deal with it now is to, in your email to the coroner's assistant after you've identified and introduced yourself, is actually ask in the email what is the scope and what are the areas that might concern or affect my client so that I can get appropriate instructions. So have a look at that because it is important. There's a practice direction about police contact deaths. practice direction about listings and medical records and coronial briefs. The one about coronial briefs is more dealing with the timing of when the briefs are going to be actually delivered to the coroner, and how many copies and things like that are to be done in those circumstances. And I think the perfect time for a breakfast break is
We're going to come back and talk about a couple of important topics which will be of interest to you, namely representing families and particularly privilege and self-incrimination. Okay.